Isn't that intro music dope? It totally is. Good evening and welcome to our post St. Patrick's Day extravaganza. Now I know what you're thinking, and no, I'm not hungover. And neither should you. Neither should you be hungover. So tonight we are diving in to the mysterious world of St. Patrick's produce. So get ready to uncover the secrets of those elusive fruits and veggies that pop up during this holiday season. And maybe even we'll learn a thing or two about the man himself, St. Patrick. So settle in and let's get ready, because this is going to be a sham-rocking time. Let's do this, boys.
Wow. Thank you, Maddie.
It's going to be a sham-rocking time. Listen.
Told you I was ready.
It gets me every time.
I'm going to write that one down.
Literally, I was laughing in the background the whole time. My cheeks hurt, and it hasn't even been a minute and a half.
All right, get me out of here.
Oh, my gosh. Thanks, Maddie.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Maddie. Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. Patrick, happy one day late St. Patrick's Day.
The day, after St. Patrick's Day, everyone. Listen, it's like the day after 4th of July. There's a few days and holidays out of the year when the next day, the news talks about people calling in sick, okay?
Yeah.
It's New Year's, that's another one. There's just certain holidays that, you know, makes you want to call in sick, right?
Oh, what did you do on St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah, well, actually, we went to the beach.
Yeah.
So we actually, it's funny you say this. So the kids were all kind of split up this weekend. So it was really just my son and my daughter, my youngest daughter, my three-year-old. And I was like, we should go to the beach and watch the sunset. And we figured there was going to be a ton of people, or at least out and about. And sure enough, there was. It took like an hour to go 12 miles. And we actually just hung out on the beach until sunset. It was a honeymoon island.
Hmm. What a romantic St. Patrick's.
I know. Listen.
Look at that.
With all the kids. So.
All right.
I had to charm three women and my son on St. Patrick's Day.
All right. Hey. Nothing wrong with that.
No. What'd you do?
I did absolutely nothing.
I like it.
I didn't have anything St. Patrick's Day themed. We just didn't do anything. Although my wife's side of the family, I think her second great grandmother is from Ireland. So we do have some Irish, but you have Irish.
We have a lot of Irish. So I've done the 23andMe?
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
I wish I could pull it up on my phone. I would show everybody. But my heritage goes back to, obviously, my dad being Canadian, my grandmother being Canadian, Scottish. And so when we did the 23andMe, John, it was like, boom. It was like 89.9% Irish. Like, Ireland, Scotland.
There was no doubts, basically.
I think, 6%. 7% was within the England area, and then it was 1% miscellaneous, you know.
Always the miscellaneous.
Yeah, there was a miscellaneous. They must have caught dry spit or something.
Yeah,
on that
something was.
it was like, what are you gonna do? So, yeah.
Good.
So, I am for sure Irish. Now, here's the crazy thing, everyone. I have not been to Ireland.
You haven't?
So, no, I haven't. My brother, though, middle brother, he has been. Him and his wife have been. He loved it. He's like, dude, you got to do it one day.
Ireland's beautiful. I've been once.
You have been?
To the west coast of Ireland. So, County Kerry.
So, what did you do over there?
I did a lot of walking.
Okay.
That was like the nature side of Ireland. So like the Cliffs of Moher, Galway, nice. Quiet, windy, lots of green, cows.
Lots of green. You know what? Jeez, I should have switched my mic out green.
Well, at least you got green. I was not good. I did not get.
You have no green on you?
No green.
I always have green on me, man.
That's true. There you go. Well, you're Irish. You're the St. Patrick.
I am the St. Patrick today.
Speaking of St. Patrick, let's delve into what we're talking about tonight here.
True.
And actually, before we get into it, if you are listening in live, because this will be posted after the fact, so this will be a little harder after the fact. But if you are listening live, feel free to chime in. Let us know where you're listening from. If you are Irish, have any Irish ancestry, and any questions, we'll try to get to them. We'll see how quickly we can get through tonight's episode on St. Patrick. So we're going to talk about who St. Patrick was to start, to kind of give you a lay of the land of where he's coming from. And then we're going to really kind of piece together what the cuisine looked like in St. Patrick's time and how it translates into today. So that's kind of a roadmap of tonight. So St. Patrick, there's going to be a lot of bombshells here to start off with. Before we get into the produce side, one, there were no snakes in Ireland, so he didn't get rid of snakes. The three-leaf clover was probably a myth that he used to explain the Holy Trinity. So those are two myths right off the bat. But perhaps one that a lot of people don't realize is St. Patrick himself was not Irish. So he was actually born in Roman Britain in the late 4th century. The exact date is not certain. And a lot of these things that we're going to be talking about tonight are not certain only because of records, and it's very long time ago, 4th century AD. So a lot of this is based on the records we can find and things of that nature. So St. Patrick was a Roman citizen born in Britain, and he was probably most likely born in Western England, likely around Wales or Scotland, and may have actually even been originally named Maegwin Sukat. That's also in dispute. Some historians agree with that, some don't. But again, so he's part of Rome. This was part of Roman's province of Britannia, which consisted of both modern-day England and Wales. And its northern border was marked by Hadrian's Wall. So the north of the wall was what the Romans called Caledonia, which is today Scotland, which they never tried to colonize. It was just too difficult. And they never even seriously tried to conquer it, Ireland either, or colonize Ireland. They referred to it as Hibernia. And it was just basically, they saw it as a cold wasteland, not, I guess, worth conquering. So what of Patrick? So Patrick, again, was a Roman in Britain, and he grew up in a high-status, slave-owning Romano-British family. So based on that, we could clearly expect him to have a very late Roman aristocratic lifestyle in his youth. Okay, so he was of the elitist class in this community. And his father, his name was Calpurnius, which suggests, again, his family was of Roman lineage. And his father was a deacon in the church, a minor Roman official, probably a tax collector. And during the early life of Patrick, during the Roman rule of Britain, was coming to an end. So we're talking about, again, late 4th century, early 5th century. So the Roman Empire is starting to collapse at this point. And potentially due to this instability, Patrick was kidnapped from his family villa by raiders from Ireland. And this wasn't an unusual occurrence. It's not like Patrick was the first Briton getting stolen off of his property in England at this time. There were lots of Irish raiders just, again, looking for slaves to serve as laborers on the other side of the water there. So he's ripped away from his home, and these Irish raiders bring him into Ireland, and they sell him off to a family who basically he serves as a sheep herder for a local chieftain on the slopes of Mount Slemish. And I think we even have a picture of the Mount Slemish, which will come up here. So you can get a sense of where he was spending his time. And he spent his time on Mount Slemish for about 6 years. There it is. If you can see it and listening live here. So he worked on this mountain for about 6 years, like I said. And during this time, you know, very lonely. Didn't have anyone to talk to, except for sheep. And God. So, like most people, stuck in a precarious situation for a long period of time, he starts having visions and conversations with God, lots of praying. And it was during this time that he really becomes very religious to the Christian faith. And so he has a calling from God saying that he has to escape, and that there's a boat waiting for him about 200 miles on the coast of Ireland that'll bring him back to Britain. So he walks this 200 miles through this Irish landscape and convinces a ship that's waiting there to carry him back to Britain. And so he was convinced again through all this process that, okay, now God obviously must have been helping him, you know, having walked through 200 miles to get to this boat, and then the boat brings him back to Britain. So he eventually gets back to Britain, and his parents beg him never to leave again, but then he begins having more visions with an angel appearing, basically echoing the voices of the Irish that he left behind, saying, we beg you, holy boy, to come and walk again among us. So he took this calling seriously, went to what was France at the time to become ordained as a deacon, and then eventually even became consecrated as a bishop. And at this point, it's believed that he was given the name Patricius, which in Latin is Patrick. And then he is asked to return to Ireland. Well, it's again disputed whether he wanted to do it on his own accord or if he was asked to by the diocese to return back to Ireland to spread Christianity. So he does go back to Ireland, where he was taken originally at age 16. And at this point, he starts to spread Christianity. And what really worked for him is that he had spent so much time amongst the Irish people that he could understand their culture, the way they do things. And so he was really able to weave in his beliefs into their existing beliefs. And so, you know, a great example is, I think we've all seen the Celtic cross. So the Irish or the Celts that were basically in that culture that was inhabiting the island at the time, the sun was a very important symbol in their pagan religion. And so Patrick said, okay, well, why don't I just slap the sun into the middle of the cross? And then that kind of confused both religions into one, easier time converting. And it worked. That's just one example. So in a nutshell, he ended up converting thousands and thousands of people. How do we know all this? Mostly because he wrote a book called The Confessio, which is sort of a spiritual autobiography about his life, beliefs, missionary work in Ireland. And there's a lot of information that he gives there about his life from the moment he was taken by these Irish raiders all the way through his time spreading Christianity. Now, of course, you always have to take some of this to a degree of salt because it is the author that's talking about himself, but it's the best resource we do have. And then he died, or is believed to have died, on March 17th, 461. And this is why we celebrate St. Patrick's Day on every March 17th, is to mark the date of his death. So this gives you a little bit of a landscape of who St. Patrick was and the environment he was living in.
Wow.
Right?
That's a lot that is a lot to unpack.
It's not a lot of leprechauns or beer or not a lot of dancing, you know. That kind of things.
Nothing to what probably a lot of other people thought.
No.
Meant.
No.
You know, I mean, heck, even me, I mean, before we did any of the research, I mean, I didn't really know the in-depth meaning behind it as well.
He's not even Irish.
It's so interesting. Like, history tells all,
it
right?
It certainly does.
And it's interesting how traditions and things around certain holidays happen. Like I said, like drinking or just like fireworks. I mean, just, you know what I mean? There's around certain holidays, things come out in people and they want to celebrate. And again, this is now we're celebrating to mark his death.
Yeah.
We celebrate a lot of deaths.
Nothing to do with Ireland, really.
But no, you know, geez. How'd the green and the beer get involved?
Oh, we'll get to that one.
You know what's funny is I was just thinking about Ross Nelson. I was like, man, he's on vacation. He hasn't popped in, and all of a sudden, gotta love green. Like all of a sudden the produce boss comes in for the clutch. Gotta love the green.
Another bombshell then. Green was not associated with Ireland. It was actually blue to begin with.
I remember seeing that.
Did you see that?
That was on our history email that we get that I said I forwarded you. Remember? You were like,
yes, you did.
I don't know how.
When I was doing my research, I saw this. So Britain kind of basically said, when they took over basically Ireland as a colony, they basically said, all right, your coat of arms is going to be this. It's going to be blue. And so it started off as blue, but then Ireland, once they got their independence, said, nah, we're not going to stick with the color that was given to us.
They said, we're done with this. We're switching it.
Exactly.
We'll switch it. So I think the next thing is that we talk about is the cuisine. You know, so what was the cuisine like in the Roman Britain kind of era? First of all, I'm going to have, if you could see the comments to the side, obviously, don't put those out yet. We'll put those out when we get to more of the middle of the show. Let's get through some of this. And John, which slides are we using for the cuisine?
Cuisine. Well, we're talking about Roman Britain. We'll look at the first of the Roman villas. So I think what's important to remember here. So Rome wasn't always in Britain. Okay.
Is that this one?
Nope. The one before. There we go.
There we go.
Beautiful Roman Britain villa. Because Rome, or the Romans rather, only set foot in Britain in 43 AD. And prior to that, the Britons were living there, you know, for 4,000 years before the Roman conquest. They were doing their own thing. Now, when Romans did show up, it's not as if these people were kind of living in forests and, you know, were backward or so. But when the Romans did arrive, there was natural clearances of the lands, suggesting that people were already cultivating fields there and pastures and farmsteads and things of that matter. But it was more of subsistence farming rather than large, you know, farming operations.
Right. Of course. More like fields, pastures, more like small cattle, right? I mean,
exactly.
Small ranches, which like you said, if you see in the, even man, this is not a huge house, everyone. This is obviously multiple areas, but look around you. If you look over there in the top right hand corner, you can tell that's a field that's probably got a certain amount of items on it. The same thing if you move over to the left, you see a bunch of people working in the field. Just if you take the left wing of the house straight up, and then even behind us, right above our heads, another field. So again, it wasn't commercially grown. Obviously farming had been around for 4,000 years by the time the Roman conquest has come.
Yep.
So the landscape, obviously you see, is being cultivated, for what they needed. Right, John, that's what I would say.
Right. I mean, that's what the Britons were doing. But then when Rome came in, the Roman Empire was arguably the most developed and powerful society at that time. And so when they occupied Britain, Rome already had an extremely well-developed agricultural system, elaborate culinary traditions, and agriculture was very important to Roman society. I mean, if you were a farmer, this was a noble way of life. Most people were farmers, 100%. And that was a very respectful, career, but life to lead. And they would take a lot of the agricultural skills and knowledge from the other cultures that they integrated within the Roman Empire. Roman Empire was all about absorbing other people's best ideas. So, you know, you had the Greeks and other cultures that they very much intertwined within their own culture.
That's why I keep telling you to watch that Interstellar movie.
I'm going to get to it.
The main people are farmers and engineers. So
yeah, let's look at, this is going to make up for our produce in space episode. I'm not going to go down that tangent yet.
We're not. Let's keep going on the influence of the Roman.
We're still in Rome.
Yeah, we're still in Rome. Influence of Roman food in Britain began you know, even before the Roman occupation, John, you know, and in fact, trade between the two countries was already flourishing, and the Celtic British elites had a taste of some of the exotic products coming from the empire, such as wine, olive oil, things like that. But it was only after the conquest when an increasingly large Roman community moved to Britain. That's right. So the ag and the culinary landscape of the country, it changed radically. So before the Romans arrived, the Bretons cultivated cereals, wheat, barley of that nature, and peas, beans, generally like we've talked about in the last few minutes, just for subsistence, not for commercials. So it starts to then focus on the Roman cuisine, was a lot more elaborate than of the Bretons, and it made an extensive use of like those exotic ingredients. Because why, John? Because they had spices and herbs, right?
Say spice is the spice of life.
They didn't have that. It was unknown. It was unknown to Britain at the time. So the Romans introduced over 50 new kinds of food plants. Here we go: figs, grapes, apples, pears, cherries, plums, damson, mulberry, date, and olive. Vegetables were things such as cucumbers, celery, nuts, seeds, lentil, pine. Also the nut category: nuts, almonds, walnuts, sesame, and then a lot of herbs and spices. So definitely a range of products for I would say the new world of them merging together. I mean, you're spicing up these people's lives.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, think about that much of new foods. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine, of course, in today's world, but where we're so globally integrated. I mean, you can buy pretty much, I mean, take a banana. Anywhere in the world, you're going to find a banana. Now, it's not, you know, it's very hard to find foods that are...
Depending on what it looks like, you should be fine, but double check. Yeah, there is a blue banana out there, everyone.
That's true. I mean, there's obviously exceptions, but to have like this level of new foods coming into your society. Now, it's important to know, it's not as if everybody had access to all of this stuff. The poorer people in Britain at this time were much slower to getting exposure to these sorts of things. But again, the Romans did bring this stuff in, and a lot of what they brought ended up staying and being cultivated and never leaving and still remain today. But in addition to all the foods they brought over, right? They were also master road builders. They loved their roads. That's what helped move their armies, helped move their goods. They were all about trade. And those roads significantly increased the movement of produce throughout the country as well.
What time period was that?
So this was as soon as they basically landed. I mean, as soon as Rome would settle and conquer a region, they would get to work to start building those roads, because again, they needed to be able to connect back to other cities in their empire. You didn't want to be disconnected from. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, you don't want to be disconnected from your motherland, your home base. So
exactly.
So that means late 4th century, Britain was a period of great change. Anglo-Saxons from Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands were just moving in and beginning to push out the Mediterranean culture and cuisine of the Romans. That, again, what I always say sometimes, John, is like, wow, look how fast it changes.
Yeah.
Changes quick. It's really fast. So who occupied Britain for several centuries? You know what I mean? That the Romans, and they didn't even think about, like, if you think about all the change that happened, these Romans literally, they had occupied Britain for several centuries, but by 410 AD, Romans would lose control of the island. The empire would fall around 476. That means, as you start to think about it, there are so many varieties of culinary experiences and influence that have come in and out between 410 AD and 476. Like, which menu do you want, John? which one, sir? Because there's a few of them in this nature.
Yeah. So Roma was in control of this island for 400 years. And now there's this is in the period of St. Patrick, right? So Patrick was born at the latter end of the 4th century, so late 300s, and it was around 410. So Patrick is maybe around 20-ish, 30-ish years old, is when the Roman control is slipping from the island. So this is a period of great change in this region from what was a very stable, super powerful empire starting on its decline. So that's Roman Britain. That's one piece of the story of Patrick, right? So that's where he spent his youth and then eventually came back for a little bit. But the other bigger piece of his life was obviously Ireland. Now, what was happening on Ireland? So as we touched on at the beginning, Ireland did not experience any sort of at least deep Roman influence. The cuisine of Ireland, for the most part, kept to its own style. Ireland at the time was made up of five provinces, governed by a king, subject to a supreme monarch. So almost like, governors and a leader basically at the top.
Okay.
And so the local diet of Ireland was pretty simple, not too dissimilar to what we were describing in Britain before the Romans arrived. So the local diet was based largely on dairy and grain, but especially oats. There were oat cakes, and these were more like hard bread or a cracker, mostly like mixtures of fruits, nuts, and oats, that sort of thing. There was thick cooking residue from the oats that might be made into sowens or a type of jelly. And oats were often cooked as oatmeals or gruels. And so we've all heard about gruels, basically just like mashed up liquidy oat. But these sorts of Irish staples served their purpose. They filled the belly, and especially when you added dairy in it, it was a hearty meal to live off of. Hazelnuts. Hazelnuts, we might not think of it, but were native also to the British Isles and were very important to Celtic mythology. And in the Celtic mythology, there were basically nine magical hazel trees that would hang over the sacred well of wisdom that would drop the hazelnuts into the well. And the water of the well would flow into streams where the magical nuts were then eaten by salmon of wisdom. And the story goes that those who consume either the nuts or the fish will gain prophetic abilities. And often stories would be told of a legendary hero that was sent on a quest to the well at the world's end to catch a sacred nut before it reached the salmon of wisdom. In addition to that elaborate story, people also in that culture believed magic wands were fashioned from hazel. It was once thought that if you were wore a crown of hazel twigs and wished very hard, your wish would come true. So maybe that's was that in Harry Potter? Hazel
nut, just saying, like
wands, maybe.
Give me my Harry Potter wand and eat me some prolific nuts to get some abilities over here, man. Like, listen, it's better than getting bit by a spider. I mean, yeah. I'm just saying, like, give me.
Yeah, those big spiders. And
those who consume either the nuts or the fish, I can eat nuts and fish, okay? Will gain prolific abilities. So often story would tell of a legendary hero sent on a quest. Okay, this might not be me. Of the world's end to catch a sacred nut before it reached the salmon of wisdom. I'm just saying, like, that sounds to me something I would do. I mean, I don't say it's me, but I would I'll eat the nut and the fish, man. I'm just saying. But, oh, man, this is crazy. So, let's see. It's considered extremely bad luck to chop down a hazel tree and was once said to be punishable by death. You know, what I'm starting to realize is that produce is involved with law, too.
Yes.
Remember in New York, you couldn't throw the banana peel on the street?
That's right, yeah.
Without, you'd get a ticket.
Roosevelt.
You get a 50-cent fine. Right, like you're like, what happened? Came home from, remember, like back in the days, you'd get you're just kind of smoking a cigarette by a police back in the day. No, not in the early 1800s, 1700s. You got, hey boy, come
serious
here,
business.
Come here, bring it over. What? They're giving you a 15-cent ticket for throwing that banana peel, right? Like, same thing. Look, hazel tree, punishable by death. So there's some crazy stuff. Tell us a little bit more, John. What were they looking for in their diet, or what came about in their diet?
So yes, we know there's nuts, there are oats.
True.
So I think we have to remember too, and we've talked about this, I think, in great length now, but there were no potatoes in Ireland at this point, right? We've done a few episodes around potatoes now. So potatoes didn't come for another 1,000 years, over 1,000 years. So this is before pre-potato period. So they existed predominantly on oats, and that's because wheat was regarded as a luxury crop. So barley was mostly for making ale. Wheat was reserved for, again, high status of bread. So you had to be kind of in the upper echelons of society to have access to that. And so the Irish diet would consist mostly of hen and goose eggs, apply for protein. You had apples and seaweed. And a popular garnish would have been watercress and wild garlic. So that kind of gives you, again, it's a very earthy kind of cuisine that's present in Ireland. Again, it's very subsistence based. But again, how do we know all this? Because again, unlike Britain, which was conquered by the Romans, and Romans had a very well-recorded written history, Ireland was not settled by the Romans. And so our records on them are really based on records that didn't come for another 400 years after this. So Irish culture at this point was pretty much all orally recorded and orally told. It was an oral tradition. By the 7th and 8th centuries, these laws and rules started to get documented, and these became known as the Brehon Laws. And these laws covered pretty much everything from land rents to beekeeping to marriage, divorce, trespassing, basically anything that you could think of that's related to an agricultural community and society. So there's some pretty wild stories.
There's a lot there. Again, we keep saying it, more law involved.
Oh yeah. There's a lot. It's like, listen to some of these laws. So there was a law in the books that had a comparative value of grain. So in the 8th century written law, it gives the order of precedence in descending order of these grains. So at the top was bread wheat, then rye, then spelt wheat, then 2-row barley, then emmer wheat, 6-row barley, and last oats. So again, we talked about oats. Oats was for the bottom. Everybody had access to that. But there was a law about what the value of these grains were. The only herb that's basically reliably identifiable from the Irish text was chives. And there were mentions of others, but there's nothing more from what we can work out from their actual identities. Some of the names are tied directly to the rank of those who ate them. So we can read about herbs that translated approximately to as king's herb, bull's herb, and that's basically for cattle owning people. So people kind of in the middle of the class, and then the plebeian herb. But we have no idea what these, again, plants were. But again, every food was very much tied to your rank in society. And somewhat related to produce, but not totally. But I thought it was a funny law on the books, and very, what can we say, feminist for the period. Husbands could be fined if they failed to get a morsel of food for their pregnant wives when requested. So for all us out there who have a wife that's been pregnant and been asked, you know, at midnight that they want pickles or something bizarre, if you did not fulfill that request under these laws, you would be fined. I don't think I could find out how much, but
I wouldn't be fined. I got her whatever she wanted.
Oh, good for you.
She's like, did you buy pickles? I was like, 2 jars.
There you go.
She's like, peanut butter? I'm like, 4 jars. I'm like, I even got some Nutella just in case if the kids wanted it. Like,
well, you got some Irish, so you know.
It's all right. I knew the consequences. An Irishman marrying a Hispanic woman. Yeah. So, yeah, someone was getting yelled at. It wasn't in my house.
No. But yeah, so I mean, we don't have really a lot of records on what Patrick actually ate in his confessio. Again, that autobiography he wrote.
Oh, wait.
Well, not you.
I was the guy at Brussels.
I know.
I was like, I really don't.
Patrick's lying. The real Patrick.
The real, yeah. I'm the real same Patrick. Patrick. Okay. See, that's not me.
It was recorded that he did eat honey and deer, That's the only thing that he did. So
honey and deer?
Honey and deer. Sweet deer. Why not? But again, based on what we kind of outlined, these are kind of the things that we could have expected Patrick to eat while he was in Britain and then in Ireland, right? So Roman Britain, Patrick would have enjoyed these exotic foods from Roman, like grapes and cherries, olives, whereas Patrick, the Irish missionary, would be kind of settling for oats, gruels, nuts, that sort of thing.
All right. Well, hold on. Hold on. Pump the brakes. Okay. First of all, can we please take a moment to thank everybody for joining? Okay.
Yeah, we should do that.
First of all, I'm looking at some of the comments. That's why I put John on full screen so we can see. Let's pop into some of the comments real quick. Someone said I've been waiting. She goes, I've been too because I'm Irish AF. That's our girl Maddie. Ross Nelson, gotta love the green. He also said who wore green yesterday, and Ross is actually coming in from Puerto Rico right now. So he just said he had to jump in really quick and have a great history lesson. We also have the Let's Play Through channel. This is a golf channel. Very interesting, guys. That's Gabe Aloisi. Gabe runs the channel. Great golfer. Let's see here. We got Maddie. Interstellar is such a good movie. I told you this, bro.
I'm going to do it. It's on the list. It's on the queue.
Okay. And then let's see. We have John Pandle that jumped in as well on LinkedIn. Salmon and hazelnuts. Much better than magic beans, Jack. He's got a point.
I think so.
Nobody's lying there. So, and I always, I commented back and was like, very true, John. This is also very true. But no, seriously, we have fun doing this and we do a lot of research. Specifically, John does a lot of great research. We talk about it, you know, and then it comes up in, you know, in some of our everyday conversations. So this is fun to us. So thank you for joining. As always, please, if you have time, follow us on Instagram as well as here on YouTube. But everyone, this is the main question I was going to ask John. And John, are you ready for it?
Cliffhanger. Okay. I'm ready. Okay,
because here it is. What's with cabbage? Why?
Sure. We haven't mentioned cabbage, have we?
No, we haven't. Yeah. And you know, that's the thing, John. What's with the cabbage in this whole thing? Why cabbage? How come St. Patrick's Day, this gentleman that's not from Ireland?
I promise you, we're going to connect all these dots. And I knew it was coming. You know, how can you not think of cabbage when you're talking about, I mean, that's the one thing you saw on the produce markets, right? When you were walking around this past week.
I'm just saying.
The cabbage and potatoes. Well, we already nixed off the potatoes. Potatoes weren't around at this point.
No. What? But in the stores this weekend.
They were, yeah.
They were everywhere.
Yeah. But cabbage. Okay, let's talk about cabbage.
Let's talk about cabbage.
So the cabbage that you have up here is like a non, I think they call it basically a non-heading cabbage. Now, I'm not a cabbage expert by any means. I had to learn a little bit about cabbage here. But this is apparently a non-heading cabbage. This I think in particular is a Savoy cabbage, but that's here or there. So non-heading cabbages and kale were probably the first to be domesticated before 1000 BC, and perhaps by the Celts of Central and Western Europe, although recent linguistic and genetic evidence enforces a Mediterranean origin of cultivated cabbages. Now, Celtic people, you might be thinking, okay, Celtic people, Ireland, why are they in Central Western Europe? So Celtic people are actually defined as those that today are associated with UK and Ireland during the Iron Age and throughout the post-Roman era. But for a very big part of their history, they were in a big chunk of Western Europe all the way into the southern parts of Europe into Asia. And so there was evidence that the Iron Age Celts were already very familiar with this plant and may have actually even influenced the Roman opinion of the plant. So again, the Celts invaded Mediterranean and Asia Minor regions sometime around 600 BC, which gave the British Isles plenty of time to establish cabbage into their culture, because the Celts would obviously bring this stuff back to their territories before the Romans invaded in 43 AD. So even though cabbage had roots in the Mediterranean, the Celts' affinity with this plant went on to actually affect the Latin word for cabbage, which is brassica, which comes from the Celtic word brassic. So there's that connection. So in Southern Europe, Mediterranean peoples developed the forms of cabbages that are tolerant to warm climates. Again, these non-hard-heading, soft-headed cabbages, which are more leafy, whereas the hard-heading cabbages, which are more of those really tight, ball-shaped cabbages, were developed in the cooler parts of Europe, and those were mostly consumed by the Celtic Nordic peoples. So that's the Celts. Now, eventually, we get the Romans in the picture, and the Romans did not know about this head cabbage, this hard head cabbage. They were all about the wild cabbages, which resemble modern-day loose-leaf kale.
Okay. I was going to say, because now if you look at, it's funny because if you look at like this cabbage compared to what we, this is even a little different than what you see traditionally at the store. This looks really different, right? So if you think about what the cabbage you see at the store today compared to what they had back then, way different, probably varieties, different, I mean, obviously, right?
Yeah.
But how, you explained how it came through. How in the world, and we're going to keep moving through this, when you think of St. Paddy's Day, you literally think of cabbage. You think of corned beef, like, right? You, some of the things, being Irish, what my dad would do on, you know, St. Patrick's Day sometimes. And it wasn't funny at all. And everyone. So I think that, you know, I'm going to let you run through the Romans, everyone, because I'm going to then take it to the Irish and the Irish American next. So, well, John, keep rolling with it, man.
You're the Irish man.
You have to.
So the Romans, so cabbage for the Romans was a luxury table food. So we might not think of cabbage as a luxury food today, but it was very much so in the Roman Empire. And so you have this traditionalist Roman statesman, Cato the Elder, who espoused to a simple republican life. He ate his cabbage cooked or raw, dressed with vinegar, and he said it surpassed all other vegetables and approvingly distinguished three varieties. He also gave directions for his medicinal use, which extended to the cabbage eater's urine, in which infants might be rinsed. Now, stay with me. I'm going to read a quote from Cato describing this very bizarre medicinal property of cabbage and urine. All right, so here we go. These are the words of Cato. If you save the urine of a person who eats cabbage habitually, heat it, and bathe the patient in it, he will be healed quickly. This remedy has been tested. Also, if babies are bathed in this urine, they will never be weakly. Those whose eyes are not very clear will see better if they are bathed in this urine, and pain in the head or neck will be relieved if the heated urine is applied. If a woman will warm the privates with this urine, they will never become diseased. The method is as follows. When you have heated it in a pan, place under a chair whose seat has been pierced, let the woman sit on it, cover her, and throw garments around her.
All right, listen.
I hope we didn't lose anybody here.
So, like, I'm not gonna lie. Like, I just jumped back to the slides. Everyone made sure I didn't have pictures of a baby, like peeing on itself.
Cabbage urine.
Yeah. What is going on?
We bring real value.
Yeah.
To these shows, you know, we want you all to know, really, that the deepest medicinal properties of these fruits and vegetables.
Like,
we don't leave any stone unturned.
When you think, like, yeah, I got to pee on myself, you know, got bit by a jellyfish, right? Nah, listen, just start bathing yourself in urine.
Yeah. So that's what the Romans thought. We're not going to dwell on the urine too long, because in addition to this
urine, it gets better.
It gets better. So cabbage was also used by the Romans as a hangover cure. And it was later even used. It was even used to reduce risk of infection. So it's carried by the men during times of war.
Right.
It was also known to be an anti-inflammatory property. So, so there are lots of medicinal properties here. But what's more is you even have a Roman emperor, which I thought this was a fun piece of history. So Diocletian was, for those that don't know this Roman emperor, he was the first retired emperor. This was unheard of. He abdicated, mostly due to illness, weakness, that sort of thing. But he was a very important emperor to Rome, but he settled and went on to live a life after. And he actually became a cabbage farmer. And the Roman Empire was at this point being ruled by a tetrarchy. So basically three other emperors, and it was kind of falling apart, and people were begging him to come out of retirement. And he responded that he would rather live in peace by tending his cabbages. And this was a quote by Diocletian. He says, "If you could show the cabbage that I planted with my own hands to your emperor, he definitely wouldn't dare suggest that I replace the peace and happiness of this place with the storms of a never satisfied greed." So that is a Roman empire, who loved his cabbage so much that he didn't dare go back to ruling Rome.
He loved his cabbage for sure.
Yeah. There's something to be said about growing things with your hand, though. It is very rewarding.
I don't want to talk about it because I do. What do they call it? Like, if you have like a green thumb, like this, like you can like grow stuff or you can't.
Yeah.
But there's been a pineapple, I got the top of a pineapple and it's been in my backyard for a while now. And I've tried to pick my Florida peaches. That hasn't worked either. It's fun, but it just, something always happens. Like, I should write like my own, what are those called? Like an act of God clause to myself, because I swear, like my peach tree, my lemon tree is dead. Like, I don't even, like, it's dead, dude. Like, gone. And I'm just, like, looking at it like a little Charlie Brown tree. Like, it'll grow back. No. I haven't been able to grow anything. So, but I do agree. I mean, it is fun. But, all right, let's get into the Irish. Okay, everyone?
Yes. How did the cabbage get to Ireland, finally?
Let's talk about how cabbage got to Ireland. So, when round-headed cabbages appeared in the 14th century, England, they were called cabbages or cabacho. It's like with an O and an A. Batches or botches. So words drawn from Old French applied at first to refer to the ball of an unopened leaf. What do we have, John? Do we have more slides? Should we be showing in this too?
I think there's a picture of green cabbage that we have these days. The white cabbage, green cabbage, whatever they call it. Those are the Romans partying.
They're partying like it's 19. Oh, wait, like it's 14.
There it is.
It almost looks like a Brussels sprout, everyone.
if you take off the leaves there, that's what you got on that cut through, right? That's what we see as cabbage today.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. The cut through.
Yeah.
So I was going to say we had to have a picture today. So where are we? So, all right. So it was not until 1536 in Europe that unmistakably, clear descriptions of hard-heading cabbage were recorded. So beginning in the 1600s, land laws forced onto the Irish by the English crown eventually led to a system where mainly British landowners controlled vast tracts of Irish farmland. So while mostly poor Irish farmers paid them rent to use their land. Man, it sounds like Hawaii, dude.
Yep.
We're going back to all these lands. It's like, it sounds like Hawaii. Now the tenant farm system, we've heard this one before. This has been, there is a lot with this, the whole tenant farm system in history, dude.
Oh yeah.
Like we should do a whole episode just of the tenant farm, systems that were owned by each land and do the wages and amount that they made back then and what inflation would be today if people still did that. Think about it. All right. I'm going to keep moving. So the tenant farmer system, left most farmers with barely enough food to survive. On since the majority of the crops they grew went to pay for proprietors, right? Yeah. So beginning in the 17th century, potatoes became their main crop. They provided high yields so farmers could pay their rents and still have something left over for dinner. That was a big thing. Pigs were the main protein for the lucky farmers, but most of the livestock also went to pay the rent. Cabbage was another vegetable these farmers and the rural poor relied on for food since it was nutrient dense and grew well in Ireland. So one of the first written accounts of cabbage cultivation comes from the 17th century, but it's likely, John, the vegetable was being grown in Ireland before this time. This just might have been, you know, where it was cultivated. What other items do we have here that keeps moving through?
Oh, that's Ireland, yeah.
This is
it's like a typical Ireland
flat
farm.
Yeah, that's kind of what they lived in.
That was your life.
Cabbage became an even more important staple during the Great Potato Famine. Oh, I remember hearing that in the potato episode, everyone. When the blight caused potatoes to begin to rot in fields and in storage bins across the land, many turned to cabbage for sustenance. So they took the lot, they ate a lot. It had been determined that the annual cabbage intake of the Irish and around that period would have been about 65 pounds per person.
Ooh. That's a lot of cabbage.
So as the famine continued, John, it continued to rage and eventually killing more than millions of people in Ireland over the course of a little more than 5 years. Waves of Irish immigrants began to hit American shores. Oh, which goes to remind me, Gangs of New York was the other movie I told you to watch when we were talking about it in the green room. Everyone, please comment if you've seen The Gangs of New York. I've told John he has to watch it. That could be a whole episode as well. Now, as we talked about the famine, it grew. I thought about Gangs of New York, got me off track. So the great quantities of, corned beef were indeed produced in Ireland beginning in the 17th century. It was mainly for export since most Irish couldn't afford the extravagance and instead ate bacon with their cabbage since pork was much more affordable. The name corned beef, coined the British, refers to the large salt crystals used in the preservation process, which were said to resemble corn kernels. Look at that.
See, that's where corned beef comes from.
Who would have thought corned beef?
Yeah, because when I was a kid, I always thought it was like there were pieces of corn in it.
And here's the Irish coming to New York, everyone.
Yeah, that's the next stage.
You want to know why? Listen, because they were going to the Five Points in New York with the Gangs of New York.
You're not gonna let go of it, huh?
Listen, you gotta watch that movie, man.
It's on the list too.
I gotta check and make sure no one chatted and said, you know, yes, Gangs of New York.
Everybody's agreeing.
who said cabbage medicine? Do not try this at home. Cabbage medicine. Do not.
Yeah, I would not. I do not endorse any of the urine
Veronica
treatments here.
Have to hop. Great program. Thanks, Veronica. Appreciate you.
So Irish. So
what about Irish in America? Why don't you talk about that, John?
Yeah, because we're getting close now. We cabbage has entered the scene. We know why cabbage intake kind of started to spike with the Irish. It was a backup to the potato. So you have this wave of Irish immigrants, like you said, that are coming into America, but where are they going? They're going mainly to big metropolitan areas. So New York, Boston, New Orleans, and in these cities, they were often living near Jewish enclaves. And that's because Irish, Italians, Jewish, these were all minority groups at the times. And they were, you know, they were kind of looked down upon by the existing American citizens. And so the Irish soon turned to the affordable, plentiful amounts of corned beef that they found at the local kosher delis for their celebratory dinners, of course, including St. Paddy's Day. And Irish immigrants really wanted this comforting dish, a taste of home, because again, food is a very deep emotional connection. So if you can have food from your home, that's a very important thing. Now, at that time, bacon was too expensive for these poor immigrants in the United States. And even if they could afford that relative luxury of pork, they also had a difficulty finding the type of bacon they were used to. So like many poor people have done through generations, they got creative. They turned beef brisket, the cheapest cut of meat available from these Jewish delis, and their Eastern European Jewish neighbors then salt cured the meat via brining. And so the corn part of the term actually refers to, again, the corn-sized salt crystals that were used during the brining, also in this Jewish process, as we saw in the British process of preparing this meat. And so it was something that they themselves were familiar with, as the corned beef was also produced in Ireland. So just not something that was popular as their beloved bacon. So bacon was the mainstay for Irish, not this corned beef. Now, what about the cabbage? Cabbage was a very cheap vegetable that they were familiar with, obviously, right? They just fled Ireland, having to basically exist on cabbage instead of the tomato. So, or not the tomato, the potato. And so the cabbage they were able to get, it was cheap. And so this became part of their in the stateside. So they had corned beef and they had cabbage. And this became integrated within the St. Patrick's Day holiday, which had been a holiday since, the early 1700s. It wasn't a holiday like it is in the States, in Ireland, even at then. So today, now, St. Patrick's Day is the biggest holiday for fresh green cabbage consumption in the United States. So that is how...
Is it really?
That's how cabbage became part of St. Patrick's Day. Now, St. Patrick himself may have had cabbage, because remember, Romans were up here in Roman Britain at the time. So it's likely he did have some kind of cabbage, but not necessarily in the same consumption levels as what the Irish were having during the Great Potato Famine, or what we see today celebrated for the holiday. And again, the holiday was turned into a holiday here to celebrate Irish culture, because again, as a lot of Irish people began settling in the United States, they wanted to have a day to celebrate their culture, and it was kind of a homesick.
Makes sense.
It was an excuse to celebrate their culture. So very far cry from what the original holiday was.
Well, then there you have it.
And there you have it. So cabbage has been around for thousands of years. Really, what, in the last 100, a little over 100 years, has become
A little
Irish
over.
Food.
A little over 100 years.
You know? So
a little over 100 years. Forget about it. Well, listen, everyone, that's our Uncovering St. Patrick's Day produce. Not me. The real St. Patrick, not the St. Patrick, the real St. Patrick. But before we finish up tonight, let's, John, you want to give them a little hint of what's to come next? I mean, we just released the Mafia episode last week. Next week, we've got a fun one. Be sure to watch our reels if you can. We're going to post some on Instagram because that's going to be funny with our Viking fellow, if you know what I mean, right?
Oh, yes.
I'm just saying. So make sure you follow us on the History of Fresh Produce. That way you can get the reels that we'll post. And then the next thing we have is an episode on the Titanic, the history of blueberries, the French Revolution, and the Golden Age of Baghdad and the Arab Empire.
Yeah.
So
lots of exciting,
got some fun stuff. And then we also, John, I know we're going to have some exciting news coming. So we're also going to do a couple more extra live streams over the next month. We got some news to announce. So it's going to be fun. You guys are going to love it. For the listeners, for the participants, we're going to have more to come. So stay tuned.
Yeah, I think you covered it all. And we're going to be recording a lot next week. We're going to actually start our recording for the Olympic series, which is going to drop during the Olympics. So get excited for that. It's going to be a lot of stories. Yeah, get excited. It's 12. What did we say? 12 episodes in a matter of 2.5 weeks that we're going to drop at that point.
Yeah, it's going to be crazy.
It's going to be intense, but there's a lot of fun stories that I think not many of our listeners will have heard about before.
It's going to be a first timer for a lot of people.
Yeah, nothing like the first time.
Not a first timers.
Like first kiss. Yeah.
Hey. This kiss.
Uh-oh. Well, incredible. Before we get into karaoke here.
All right, everyone. Great to see you.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And again, yeah, stay tuned next week, Vikings. And we will drop when our next live stream will be, probably in the next week or two again. So
soon.
Soon.
Soon. Soon, next right? month. Soon. See you next month.
Right.
John?
All right. Good night, everybody. Thanks again. And we'll see you soon.